Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 9 Presidents Who Screwed Up America and 4 Who Tried to Save Her by Brian McClanahan, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Introduction. Presidents have been judged on their job performance since George Washington took the first oath of office on April 30, 1789. Not even he was immune from criticism, some of it harsh. The essayist Tom Paine wrote a stinging rebuke of the Washington administration and of Washington's character just before the first president left office in 1797. Every administration has had its critics. We can often learn more from opponents of an administration than from those who supported the president. Not that the critics are always correct. Hardly. But criticism shouldn't be dismissed as simply a partisan political maneuver. Partisan critics can be prescient. We fear those in power who think and act least like us, and therefore scrutinize their every decision. This would be the founders' position as well. Jealousy guarding constitutional limitations on the executive is a healthy reaction from the American polity. With each successive administration, Americans have compared and measured the man in office against his predecessors. Even presidents themselves have attempted to attach their administration to supposed greats of the past. These comparisons provide perspective in the maelstrom of American politics. In the modern era, last week's news might as well have been 200 years ago. But by showing continuity between Abraham Lincoln and Barack Obama, for example, politicians hope to persuade the American public to buy their pitch and support their policies. If Franklin Roosevelt did it, then it should be good enough for George W. Bush or Bill Clinton. The right presidential yardstick. But how do Americans measure presidential success? By popularity? Effective communication? Success in achieving foreign or domestic policy goals? Energy and activity in the office? Leadership? The overall health of the country during and immediately after a president's administration? An ideological disposition similar to that of the person ranking the president? This is a difficult question, and one that Americans have pondered for decades. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Sr. conducted the first academic poll that attempted to rank the presidents for a 1948 issue of Time magazine. The 55 academics surveyed found 6 presidents to be great: Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Franklin Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Thomas Jefferson, and Andrew Jackson. Schlesinger followed up in a 1962 poll of 75 historians for the New York Times magazine. This poll dropped Jackson from the great category, but otherwise the list remained static. The historians Schlesinger surveyed were generally left-of-center academics who favored the policies and qualities of the men on the list. Lincoln, Wilson, and FDR were reformers. Jackson presided over the age of democracy. Jefferson, as the first people's president, is always portrayed, incorrectly, as a modern liberal. And Washington was the glue that held the Federal Republic together. On this list, only Jefferson's administration could be classified as less than energetic, at least in regard to the public perception of the office. Jefferson deliberately downgraded the presidency during his first term in office. Washington's careful implementation of executive powers had established precedents for executive conduct. But few followed his advice, and even he disregarded the Constitution during his second term. With the exception of Grover Cleveland, the great and above-average presidents in each poll were cut from the same cloth. Teddy Roosevelt, John Adams, and James K. Polk, along with Cleveland, were in the above-average category in the 1948 poll, and Harry Truman and Jackson joined that category in the 1962 poll. Roosevelt was a progressive who believed in an energetic executive. Adams, though a member of the founding generation, had a much more active executive office than any other member of that generation. In one term, Polk acquired California and most of the desert Southwest through a war with Mexico and secure the Oregon Territory from Great Britain. Truman was a World War II president, stared down communists in Asia, and gave Americans a fair deal. Cleveland is the only outlier. He used the office of president the way the founding generation intended, by vetoing unconstitutional legislation and avoiding foreign entanglements. This, however, would be the best Cleveland would fare in any poll until 2005. Polls in subsequent years by different academics and publications remained fairly consistent, perhaps because of the fact that the historians surveyed generally used the same criteria for determining the greatness of the president, namely leadership qualities, vision, and success in achieving their desired foreign or domestic policy goals. Every great president in the Schlesinger polls remained in the top group in the polls. Opinions varied for the rest of the presidents, but there was also a consistent trend in the bottom group. John Tyler, James Buchanan, Franklin Pierce, Warren G. Harding, Andrew Johnson, Zachary Taylor, and Calvin Coolidge were generally held in low esteem in every academic poll conducted from 1948 to 2005. The below-average to poor presidents tend to be those who had forgettable administrations. They did not have grand foreign or domestic policy accomplishments, or those who supposedly blundered through a crisis such as the early stages of the Great Depression or the start of the Civil War. The problem with these academic polls is not the questions, but the perception of the executive office, a perception that has been skewed by the success of the United States in the 20th century, and the growth of the power of the executive branch vis-a-vis the other branches and levels of government. The historians who participated in these polls lacked an originalist perspective on the Constitution. So they ranked the presidents based on the outcome of their policies, not on how they upheld the oath they took when sworn into office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. A ranking of the presidents on that basis would be a bit more difficult. The historian would have to understand how the proponents of the Constitution in 1787 and 1788 argued executive powers would be implemented once the Constitution was ratified. Most don't. Certainly, historians read the famous Federalist Essays, but the real debates took place in the ratifying conventions themselves and among less conspicuous but equally important members of the founding generation, men such as John Dickinson, Roger Sherman, James Wilson, James Iredell, William Richardson Davey, John Rutledge, Oliver Ellsworth, and Edmund Randolph. These men argued that the president was not to be a king, nor would he have the power George III had in England. But the understanding of the executive branch among most Americans, including historians, has been distorted. We ask what we think the president should do in office, not what he is constitutionally permitted to do in office. The latter should be the measure of the man. Turning the rankings upside down. Under those criteria, the traditional presidential rankings should be inverted, with just a few exceptions. Generally, those at the bottom of the lists tended to hew to greater constitutional restraint than those at the top. If we judge presidents not on their policies or ideas, but simply on their actions measured against the definition of the office of president in the Constitution, as it was sold to reluctant delegates at the state ratifying conventions and in the press, then the great executives look more like John Tyler or Calvin Coolidge than Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln. We may admire the policy outcomes of the anointed great presidents. Indeed, some of these policies have had a dramatic and beneficial effect on American society. But that does not mean these men were adhering to their oath. In most cases, they weren't. Some of the men who would fare better under an originalist evaluation held views repugnant to modern Americans. But that does not make their stand for limitations on central power any less important. Potential executive abuse was one of the most feared results of the ratification of the Constitution. The founding generation considered an out-of-control executive to be the greatest bane to liberty. The Constitution was ratified on a certain understanding of the office of president, of its powers, and above all, of its limitations. The men who hold that office have no right to exceed those limits. When they do so, they are breaking their inaugural oath and straining to the breaking point the very compact that our government is founded on. Achieving other goals, however laudable, can never excuse actions that violate the fundamental understanding to which the consent of the governed was accorded when our constitutional government was established. And the violation of that principle has very practical consequences. As we shall see throughout this book, unconstitutional government is irresponsible government. When the executive arrogates to itself powers that the Constitution does not grant, when unelected bureaucrats usurp the powers that the states and the people delegated only to their elected representatives, then the general government is no longer responsible to the states or the people. As the history laid out below demonstrates, what follows inevitably on the abandonment of constitutional principle is irresponsible policy, dangerous to the health and even the survival of the republic, from ruinous deficits to out-of-control foreign adventurism. In the Constitution, the founding generation left us a vehicle for preserving self-government. We ignore it at our peril. This book was born during the marketing campaign for my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. My assertion that nearly every president in the last 100 years should be impeached created quite a stir. I had to explain, and one or two sentences were not enough to do the argument justice. This work is not a comprehensive ranking of all the presidents. It is designed to shed light on those who screwed up America and those who tried to save her using a simple formula. Did the man in office adhere to his oath to defend the Constitution as ratified by the founding generation? And if not, where did he go off the rails? The identities of the nine men who screwed things up may shock the modern reader. After all, many of them have been called great presidents, including Jackson, Lincoln, Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt, while Teddy Roosevelt and Truman are always regarded as near great. I listed Jackson as a true American hero in my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Real American Heroes, but that does not mean he should get a free pass for violating his oath. Jackson established precedents that allowed future presidents to deviate even further from the Constitution. He was a good general, but a terrible president. The other men in the list of those who screwed things up, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Barack Obama, have been generally ranked based on the politics of the person reviewing their records in office. Conservatives may rate Nixon highly, but condemn the administrations of Johnson and Obama, while those on the left would champion Obama and perhaps Johnson, while classifying Nixon as a crook and a war criminal. But none of these men followed their oath, and in fact, all of them established dangerous patterns that have created the modern imperial presidency, a thinly veiled elected monarchy with more power than George III exercised at the time of the American War for Independence. The four men who tried to save America are of a different stripe. Each of the four took office in a transitionary period. Jefferson called his election in 1800 a revolution. Tyler assumed office after the sudden death of President William Henry Harrison, proceeded to reverse the policies of the party which had elected him vice president in 1840, and as a result was booted from the party. Cleveland was the first Democrat elected since 1856, and he set out to undo nearly two decades of unconstitutional Republican legislation. Coolidge, like Tyler, took office through succession. and though his administration continued some of the policies of his predecessor, Coolidge was his own man and a far more effective originalist president than anyone else in the 20th century. Yet of this group, only Jefferson is generally held in high esteem by the historical profession and the public at large. In contrast, I give him credit only for his first term. The second was a disaster, at least according to the Constitution as ratified. Tyler, Cleveland, and Coolidge are typically either forgotten or shunned by presidential experts, considered to be abject failures, or characterized as spineless do-nothings who accelerated political or economic ruin. These charges are not only false, but are indicative of a larger problem. Many historians, and too many Americans in general, seem to believe that presidential authority is virtually unlimited, that it is both necessary and competent to solve the crisis of the hour, and that the unconstitutional usurpation of power is admirable executive energy. In reality, all four men who tried to save America displayed a resolve in executive restraint, a much more difficult but necessary achievement in a federal republic designed to have limited enumerated powers. The founding generation considered self-control a key measure of character. Anyone with enough political clout can abuse power. Restraint requires more tenacity and backbone than rampant, damaging, and often narcissistic autocratic rule. Executive restraint is a republican virtue, passed down from the great example of the Roman Cincinnatus, the general who saved Rome from collapse, but then gave up power willingly to return to his fields and resume his life as a farmer. It is essential for the health and stability of our federal republic. Following the Constitution and the oath of office is often not the popular path. The four presidents who tried to save America took this perilous trail. That should be admired, not condemned. It also should be noted that none of the men who tried to save her were pushovers in office. They typically deferred to Congress when the Constitution required they do so, and they let Congress lead the legislative process. That was the proper course constitutionally. But Congress often characterized them as too strong and too willing to wield executive power. That should say something about the charge that they were executive lightweights. These four men exercised power not for political gain, but to defend the Constitution from radical departures from its original intent. They defended their oath. If Americans believe in a federal republic with limited powers, defined by a written constitution, with checks and balances, not only between the three branches of the general government, but also between the general and state governments, then the four men who tried to save constitutional government in our republic should be regarded as the greatest presidents in American history. They must be our standard. Our future executives should be more like Tyler than either Roosevelt in the use of executive powers, and more like Cleveland or Coolidge than Obama in regard to character. The presidency is a potentially dangerous office that, regardless of which party controls it, should always be viewed with suspicion. A return to this type of vigilance would protect both individual liberty and the liberty of the community from executive abuse. As we enter another presidential election season, that should be our goal. A proper understanding of the president's limited powers under our Constitution should guide the way all Americans vote. The Founders' Executive. The Founders left clues in the historical record, some of them more conspicuous than others, which defined their vision for the executive branch. They articulated that vision in the Constitution for the United States, and specifically in the enumerated powers of the new presidency. A written constitution established constraints, because history had proven that the executive, whether a king, a dictator, a czar, a tyrant, a pharaoh, or an emperor, was the greatest threat to liberty. Thus, in order to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, the founders believed a codification of executive powers was needed. In fact, not all of them were convinced it would be enough. In the years leading to the American War for Independence, the founding generation implored George III to intercede on their behalf and stop unconstitutional parliamentary acts. They thought that only the king had dominion over the colonies, that they had no representation in the parliament, and that any attempt to legislate for them, with the exceptions of trade and defense, was repugnant to the unwritten British Constitution. The American colonists regarded King George III as the final check on the legislative branch. His veto could stop Parliament's tyrannical acts. Several times the colonists appealed directly to the king. He failed to act, and therefore the Declaration of Independence was a direct indictment of the king. George III became the lightning rod for colonial discontent, the despot and tyrant who had refused to intercede and use his constitutional powers to arrest the hand of Parliament. There were precedents in British history. The barons who forced King John to sign the Magna Carta in 1215 emphasized that the king was not above the law. The English Civil War, 1642 to 1651, was in part a struggle for power between the king and Parliament. King Charles I lost his head during the war. But then Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector, assumed greater power than King Charles ever had in England. The English people belatedly recognized this fact, deposed Cromwell's son in 1660, and exhumed and mauled the Lord Protector's body. He had been dead and buried for only 2 years. Heavy-handed executive rule was not welcome in England. Finally, the bloodless, glorious revolution of 1688 placed restrictions on the king. William III had to formally recognize restrictions on his power as a condition of assuming the throne. The English Bill of Rights of 1689 was an attempt to place limitations on executive power and preserve the ancient rights of Englishmen, rights the colonists would insist they retained even after their emigration to the New World. Thomas Jefferson copied some of the language and form for the Declaration of Independence from the English Bill of Rights. All this history played a part in the drafting of the several state constitutions during the American War for Independence and in the structure of the Articles of Confederation, the first governing document for the United States of America. The 1780 Constitution of Massachusetts, for example, granted little power to the executive branch. The governor of Massachusetts faced annual elections and had to concede to the supremacy of the Massachusetts General Court. Other state constitutions charted a similar course, and most of them checked executive power through an advisory council. The constitutions of the several states charged the executive branch with enforcing the laws, directing the state militias, and appointing civil officers, but the state governors were constrained by the declared powers and could not exceed their constituted authority. That was the point of a written constitution. The Articles of Confederation, proposed in 1776 and ratified by all the states in 1781, did not have an executive branch or a judicial branch, and executive tasks were carried out by the presiding officer of Congress. Each state had a republican form of government, including an executive. But the members of the founding generation had been fighting a long and bloody war with Great Britain partially over executive usurpation of power. Thus, the colonists deemed it inexpedient to place the new union of states under the thumb of another powerful central government with substantial executive authority. Several events led some members of the founding generation to reconsider their opposition to executive authority. Under the Articles of Confederation, the United States lacked a unified foreign policy. States could negotiate different treaties with foreign powers. The lack of an executive branch was also blamed for the inability for the general government to quiet unrest in the states, particularly during Shays' Rebellion in 1786. An independent executive branch came to be seen as a potential panacea for a government deemed too weak to operate effectively in both foreign and domestic policy. Avoiding an elective monarchy. The need for an executive branch became one of the rallying cries for a new constitution at the Philadelphia Convention in 1787. But the prospect of a federal executive also aroused considerable opposition. In the Constitutional Convention of 1787, James Madison called for a national executive to be elected by the national legislature in his famous Virginia Plan. But Charles Pinckney of South Carolina feared that the convention might create the worst kind of executive, an elected king. And when James Wilson of Pennsylvania proposed that the executive consist of a single person, the convention sat in stunned silence, assuredly frightened that such a move smacked of the tyranny they had just seceded from in 1776. The American sage Benjamin Franklin broke the silence by asking the convention for its opinion on the subject. John Rutledge of South Carolina suggested that a single executive was probably best, but he was against investing the power of the sword in the new branch of government. Even Wilson, who pursued a single executive with more vigor than any man in the convention, save Alexander Hamilton, thought that the only powers the executive should have were executing the laws and appointing officers. Roger Sherman of Connecticut agreed. According to Madison's notes on the convention, Sherman considered the executive magistracy as nothing more than an institution for carrying the will of the legislature into effect. Simply put, to these proponents of the new Constitution, the president would execute the laws of Congress, nothing more. But this promise of an executive with limited powers did not effectively persuade several of the delegates to the convention to support the new Constitution. Its opponents consistently pointed out the potential for executive abuse. During the convention, Edmund Randolph of Virginia claimed the executive branch was the fetus of monarchy. When the Constitution was sent to the states for ratification, George Mason of Virginia warned that unless there was some sort of check on the executive branch's power, the government will degenerate into a monarchy, a government so contrary to the genius of the people that they will reject even the appearance of it. He also thought that without a council of advisors chosen to represent the various sections of the Union, the new president will generally be directed by minions and favorites, or he will become a tool of the Senate, or a council of state will grow out of the principal officers of the great departments. The worst and most dangerous of all ingredients for such a council in a free country. Such a warning seems prescient today, particularly after the last half of the 20th century, when presidents continually relied on friends for advice and appointed close associates to the most powerful positions in the cabinet. But what can the president do constitutionally? Article 2 of the Constitution is brief and the language seemingly vague. If we are to evaluate the president from an originalist position, then we must understand what powers the proponents of the Constitution said the executive would possess, and what powers they claimed were denied to him by the document. This is the understanding of the presidency that was proposed to the people of the states when the Constitution was ratified. Limited powers. Wilson considered the powers of the British monarch to be too extensive, for they extended to prerogatives of a legislative nature and that of war and peace, etc. The new president, he claimed, would not have such authority. Madison suggested that the president should have power to carry into effect the national laws, to appoint to offices.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?